marble rose and fell and rose and fell, and the sneakers squeaked on the marble floors. It wasn't hard to pick out Killian. He was near the elevators in another of his Sharpie outfits, a pale gray suit with wide chalk stripes and a shirt with a white spread collar and maroon pinstripes. He was talking to a small, middle-aged white man in a warm-up jacket. As Sherman walked up, he heard Killian say,
"A discount for cash? Get out of here, Dennis. What are you, what are you?"
The little man said something.
"It's not a big thing, Dennis. Cash is all I get. Half of my clients ain't been introduced to checking accounts as it is. Besides, I pay my fucking taxes. That's one less thing to worry about."
He saw Sherman walking up, nodded, then said to the little man,
"What can I tell you? It's like I said, get it to me by Monday. Otherwise, I can't get started."
The little man followed Killian's eyes toward Sherman, said something in a low voice, then walked off, shaking his head. Killian said to Sherman,
"How you doing?"
"Fine."
"You ever been here before?"
"No."
"The biggest law office in New York. You see those two guys over there?"
He motioned toward two white men in suits and ties, roaming among the huddles of dark people.
"They're lawyers. They're looking for clients to represent."
"I don't understand."
"It's simple. They just walk up and say, 'Hey, you need a lawyer.'"
"Isn't that ambulance chasing?"
"That it is. See that guy over there?"
He pointed to a short man in a loud checked sport jacket standing in front of a bank of elevators.
"His name is Miguel Escalero. They call him Mickey Elevator. He's a lawyer. He stands there half the morning, and every time somebody who looks Hispanic and miserable walks up, he says, 'Necesita usted un abogado?' If the guy says, 'I can't afford a lawyer,' he says, 'How much you got in your pocket?' If the guy has $50, he got himself a lawyer."
Sherman said, "What do you get for $50?
He'll walk the guy through a plea or an arraignment. If it actually involves working for the client, he don't want to know about it. A specialist. So how you doing?"
Sherman told him of his vain attempts to reach Maria.
"Sounds to me like she's got herself a lawyer," said Killian.
As he spoke, he rolled his head around with his eyes half-closed, like a boxer loosening up for a fight. Sherman found this rude, but said nothing. "And the lawyer's telling her not to talk to me?"
"That's what I'd tell her if she was my client. Don't mind me. I did a bunch of restless bridges yesterday. I think I did something to my neck."
Sherman stared at him.
"I used to like to run," said Killian. "But all that pounding up and down screwed up my back. So now I go to the New York Athletic Club and lift weights. I see all these kids doing restless bridges. I guess I'm too old for restless bridges. I'm going to try to get hold of her myself."
He stopped rolling his head.
"How?" "I'll think of something. Half of my practice consists of talking to people who are not anxious to talk."
"To tell you the truth," said Sherman, "this really surprises me. Maria's not the cautious type. She's an adventuress. She's a gambler. This little southern girl from nowhere who makes it to 962 Fifth Avenue, I don't know. And this may sound naive, but I think she genuinely feels something for me. I think she loves me."
"I bet she loves 962 Fifth, too," said Killian. "Maybe she figures it's time to stop gambling."
"Perhaps," said Sherman. "But I just can't believe she would disappear on me. Of course, it's only been 2 days."
"If it comes to that," said Killian, "we have an investigator works right out of our office. Used to be a detective in major cases with the police department. But there's no point in running up expenses unless we really need to. And I don't think we're going to need to. Right now, they got nothing. I talked to Bernie Fitzgibbon. You remember the fellow I was talking to you about? In a homicide bureau to Bronx DA's office?"
"You've already talked to him?"
"Yeah. The press has put pressure on him. So they're checking out cars. That's all that's happening. They got nothing."
"How can you be sure?"
"What do you mean?"
"How can you be sure he'll tell you the truth?"
"Oh, he might not tell me everything he knows, but he's not going to lie to me. He's not going to mislead me." Why not?
Killian looked out over the lobby of 100 Center Street. Then he turned back to Sherman.
You ever heard of Favor Bank?
The Favor Bank? No.
Well, everything in this building, everything in a criminal justice system in New York, operates on favors. Everybody does favors for everybody else. Every chance they get, they make deposits in the Favor Bank. One time when I was starting out as an assistant DA, I was trying a case, and I was up against this lawyer, an older guy, and he was just tying me up in knots. The guy was Jewish. I didn't know how to handle him. So I talked it over with my supervisor, who was a harp like me. The next thing I know, he's taking me in to see the judge in his chambers. The judge was a harp, too, an old guy with white hair. I'll never forget it. We walk in, and he's standing beside his desk playing with one of these indoor putting sets. You hit the golf ball along the carpet, and instead of a hole, there's this cup with a rim on it that slopes down. He don't even look up. He's lining up his putt. My bureau chief leaves the room, and I'm standing there, and the judge says, Tommy. He's still looking at the golf ball. Tommy, he calls me, and I never laid eyes on him except in the courtroom. Tommy, he says, you seem like a good lad. I understand there's a certain Jew bastard been giving you a very hard time. I'm fucking astounded. This is so irregular. You know, forget about it. I can't even think of what to say. Then he says, I wouldn't worry about it anymore, Tommy. He still don't look up. So I just said, thank you, Judge, and left the room. After that, it's the judge who's tying up this lawyer in knots. When I say objection, I can't get to the second syllable before he says sustained. All of a sudden, I look like a genius. So this was a pure deposit in a favor bank. There was absolutely nothing I could do for that judge, not then. A deposit in a favor bank is not quid pro quo. It's saving up for a rainy day. In criminal law, there's a lot of gray areas, and you gotta operate in them. But if you make a mistake, you can be in a whole lot of trouble, and you're gonna need a whole lot of help in a hurry. I mean, look at these guys. He gestured toward the lawyers prowling among the people in the lobby, and then toward Mickey Elevator. They could be arrested. Without the favor bank, they'd be finished. But if you've been making your regular deposits in the favor bank, then you're in a position to make contracts. That's what they call big favors, contracts. You have to make good on contracts. You have to? Why? Because everybody in the courthouse believes in a saying, what goes around comes around. That means if you don't take care of me today, I won't take care of you tomorrow. When you got basically no confidence in your own abilities, that's a frightening idea.
So, you asked your friend Fitzgibbon for a contract? Is that the expression?
No. What I got from him was just an everyday favor, just your standard protocol. There's nothing to waste a contract on yet. My strategy is things shouldn't reach that point. Right now, it seems to me, the loose cannon is your friend Mrs. Ruskin.
I still think she'll get in touch with me.
If she does, I tell you what you do. Set up a meeting with her, and then call me. I'm never away from my telephone for more than an hour, not even on weekends. I think you ought to go wired.
Wired? Sherman sensed what he meant, and was appalled.
Yeah, you ought to wear a recording device.
A recording device? Beyond Killian's shoulder, Sherman became aware once more of the vast and bilious gloom of the lobby. Of the dark, shambling forms leaning into the telephone shells, wandering this way and that with their huge sneakers and curious rolling gaits, huddling together in their miserable tete-a-tetes. Of Mickey Elevator, cruising along the edges of this raggedy and miserable herd.
Nothing to it, said Killian, apparently thinking that Sherman's concern was technological. We tape the recorder to the small of your back. The microphone goes under your shirt. It's no bigger than the last joint of your little finger.
Look, Mr. Killian, call me Tommy. Everybody else does.
Sherman paused and looked at the thin Irish face rising up from out of a British spread collar. All at once, he felt as if he were on another planet.
he would call him neither Mr. Killian nor Tommy. "I'm worried about all this," he said, "but I'm not so worried that I would make a surreptitious recording of a conversation with someone I feel close to. Let's just forget about that."
"It's perfectly legal in the state of New York," said Killian. "And it's done all the time. You have every right to record your own conversations. You can do it on the telephone. You can do it in person."
"That's not the point," said Sherman. Involuntarily, he thrust his Yale chin upward. Killian shrugged.
"Okay. All I'm saying is it's kosher, and sometimes it's the only way to hold people to the truth."
Sherman started to enunciate a great principle, but was afraid Killian might take it as an insult. So he settled for, "I couldn't do it."
"All right," said Killian. "We'll just see how things go. Try to get hold of her anyhow, and call me if you do, and I'm going to take a shot at it myself."
As he left the building, Sherman noticed morose huddles of people on the steps. So many young men with stooped shoulders, so many dark faces. For an instant, he could see the tall, thin boy and the powerful brute. He wondered if it was entirely safe to be in the vicinity of a building that daily, hourly, brought together so many defendants in criminal cases. Where Albert Vogel found these places, Fallow couldn't begin to imagine. The Juan Lee was as pompous and stiff-necked as the Regent's Park, despite the fact that they were in the East 50s near Madison Avenue, at the height of the lunch hour. The restaurant was nearly silent. It may or may not have been two-thirds empty. It was difficult to say because of the darkness and the screens. The restaurant was all booths and pierced screens carved of dark wood with innumerable fishhook shapes. The darkness was such that even Vogel, barely 2 feet away in the booth, looked like a Rembrandt. A high-lit face, a shaft of light turning his old grandmotherly head a brilliant white, a flash of shirt front bisected by a necktie, and the rest of his form dissolved into the blackness that surrounded it. From time to time, Chinese waiters and busboys materialized soundlessly in stewards' jackets and black bow ties. Nevertheless, lunch with Vogel at the Juan Lee had one great thing to recommend it. The American would pay for it. Vogel said,
"You sure you won't change your mind, Pete? They have a great Chinese wine here. You ever tried Chinese wine?"
"Chinese wine tastes like dead mouse," said Fallow.
"Tastes like what?"
"Dead mouse." Fallow didn't even know why he said it. He wasn't using that expression anymore. He wasn't even thinking it. He was now marching shoulder to shoulder with Gerald Steiner through the world of tabloid journalism, thanks in part to Albert Vogel, although mainly thanks to his own brilliance. He was already in a mood to forget the contribution of Al Vogel to his lamb case scoop. He resented the man, with his Pete this and Pete that, and he felt like mocking him. On the other hand, Vogel was his pipeline to bacon in that crowd. He wouldn't like to have to deal with them entirely on his own.
"Sometimes I prefer a beer with Chinese food, Al," said Fallow.
"Yeah, I can see that," said Vogel. "Hey, waiter! Waiter! Christ, where are the waiters? I can't see anything in here."
A beer would, in fact, be fine. Beer was practically a health food drink, like chamomile tea. His hangover today wasn't serious at all, no more than a thick fog. No pain, just the fog. Yesterday, thanks to his enhanced status at the City Light, he had found the moment right to invite the sexiest of the copy girls, a big-eyed blonde named Darcy Lestrega, out to dinner. They went to Lester's, where he had made his peace with Britt Withers and even with Caroline Heftshank. They had ended up at The Table, with Nick Stopping and Tony and St. John and Billy Cortez and some of the others. The Table had found a perfectly willing fish in no time, a Texan named Ned Perch, who had made an astonishing amount of money at something or other and had bought a lot of old silver in England, as he kept mentioning. Fallow entertained the table at considerable length with stories about the housing project in the Bronx, by way of acquainting everyone with his recent success. His date, Miss Darcy LaStrega, was not captivated, however. The likes of Nick Stopping and St. John immediately sized her up for what she was, a humorless little American dimwit, and nobody bothered to talk to her, and she began slumping more and more despondently into her chair. To rectify matters, every 20 or 30 minutes, Fallow turned toward her, and grasped her forearm and put his head close to hers and said, in what was supposed to seem only a half-jesting manner,
"I don't know what's coming over me. I must be in love. You're not married, are you?"
The first time, she obliged him with a smile. The second and third times, she didn't. The fourth time, she wasn't there any longer. She had left the restaurant, and he hadn't even noticed. Billy Cortez and St. John began laughing at him, and he took it badly. A childish little American bird. And yet it was humiliating. After no more than 3 or 4 more glasses of wine, he left Lester's himself, without saying goodbye to anyone, and went home, and presently fell asleep. Vogel had managed to find a waiter and order some beer. He also asked for some chopsticks. The Juan Lee was so frankly commercial and unconcerned about authenticity, they set the tables with ordinary hotel silverware. How very American it was to assume that these unsmiling Chinese would be pleased if one showed a preference for their native implements. How very American it was to feel somehow guilty unless one struggled over rice noodles and lumps of meat with things that looked like enlarged knitting needles. While chasing some sort of slippery little dumpling around a bowl, Vogel said to Fallow,
"Well, Pete, tell the truth. Didn't I tell you? Didn't I tell you this was going to be a great story?"
That wasn't what Fallow wanted to hear. He didn't want to hear that the story, the lamb case itself, was great. So he only nodded. Vogel must have picked up this brainwave, because then he said,
"You've really started something. You've got this whole town talking. The stuff you've written, it's dynamite, Pete, dynamite."
Suitably flattered, Fallow now suffered a spasm of gratitude.
"I must admit I was skeptical the first time we spoke, but you were correct."
He lifted his glass of beer as if making a toast. Vogel lowered his chin practically into the bowl in order to gobble up the dumpling before it squirted out from between the tips of the chopsticks.
"And the great thing, Pete, is that this isn't just one of those passing sensations. This thing gets down to the very structure of the city itself, the class structure, the racial structure, the way the system is put together. That's why it means so much to Reverend Bacon. He's really grateful for what you've done."
Fallow resented these reminders of Bacon's proprietary interest in the story. Like most journalists who have been handed a story, Fallow was eager to persuade himself that he had discovered and breathed life into this clay himself. "He was telling me," Vogel continued, "he was saying how he was amazed. You're from England, Pete. But you come here and you put your finger right on the central issue, which is how much is a human life worth? Is a black life worth less than a white life? That's what makes this thing important." Fallow floated in the syrup for a while, and then began to wonder where this disquisition was leading.
"But there's one aspect of this thing it seems to me you might hit a little harder, and I was talking to Reverend Bacon about this."
"Oh?"
said Fallow.
"What's that?"
"The hospital, Pete. So far the hospital has gotten off kind of easy, considering. They say they're investigating how this kid could come in with a subdural concussion and just get treated for a broken wrist. But you know what they're gonna do. They're gonna try to waffle out of it."
"That may very well be," said Fallow. "But they maintain that Lamb never told them he'd been struck by a car."
"The kid was probably already half out of his head, Pete. That's precisely what they should have detected, his general condition. That's what I mean about a black life and a white life. No, I think it's time to come down hard on the hospital, and this is a good time to do it. The story has died down a little bit, because the cops haven't found the car and the driver."
Fallow said nothing. He resented being steered like this. Then he said,
I'll think it over. It seems to me they've made a rather complete statement, but I'll think it over.
Fogel said, Well now, Pete, I want to be completely open with you. Bacon has already been in touch with Channel One about this angle, but you've been our main man, as the saying goes, and we'd like to see you stay out in the lead on this story.
Your main man? What an odious presumption.
But he hesitated to let Vogel know how offensive it was. He said,
What is this cozy connection between Bacon and Channel One?
What do you mean?
He gave them an exclusive on the first demonstration.
Well, that's true, Pete. I'm going to be completely open with you. How did you know about that?
They're whatever you call it. Anchorman told me. Corso.
Ah. Well, the thing is, you gotta work that way. TV news is all PR. Every day the TV news operations wait for PR people to submit menus of things they can film, and then they choose a few. The trick is to know how to appeal to them. They're not very enterprising. They feel a lot better if they've seen something in print first.
In the City Light, just to cite a possible example,
said Fallow. Well, that's true. I'm going to be completely out front with you, Pete. You're a real journalist. When these TV channels see a real journalist onto something, they hop to it. Fallow sat back and took a leisurely draught of beer in the doldrum gloaming of the Juan Lee. Yes, his next coup would be a story exposing television news for what it really was. But for now, he would forget that. The way the television news people came running in his footsteps on the Lamb case, nothing had ever made him look quite so good. Within a few minutes, he had worked it out in his mind that a story on the hospital's negligence was nothing more than the natural next step. He would have thought of that on his own, inevitably, with or without this ridiculous yank in his chubby face, pinky-winky as could be. Today's sandwiches came to Jimmy Coey, Ray Andreuti, and Larry Kramer from the state of New York, courtesy of the Willie Francisco case. It had taken Judge Melnick a mere 4 days to ask around and find out what his opinion was of Willie's petition for a mistrial, and this morning he had given it. He declared a mistrial, based on the fat old Irish juror McGuigan's attack of the doubts. But since the day had begun with the trial technically still in progress, Bernie Fitzgibbon's secretary, Gloria, was entitled duly to order the sandwiches. Ray was once more lunging across his desk, eating a super sub and drinking his vat of yellow coffee. Kramer was eating a roast beef that tasted like chemicals. Jimmy was scarcely touching his. He was still moaning over the disintegration of such an easy one. He had an outstanding record. The Homicide Bureau kept actual standings, like baseball standings, showing how many guilty pleas and guilty verdicts each assistant district attorney had scored, and Jimmy Coey hadn't lost a case in 2 years. His anger had now developed into an intense hatred of Willie Francisco and the vileness of his deed, which to Andreuti and Kramer sounded like just another piece of shit. It was strange to see Jimmy in this state. Ordinarily, he had the black Irish coolness of Fitzgibbon himself. "I've seen this happen before," he said. "You put these germs on trial and they think they're stars. You see Willie in there jumping up and down and yelling mistrial?" Kramer nodded yes. "Now he's a legal expert. In fact, he's one of the stupidest fucks ever went on trial in Bronx County. I told Beidelberg 2 days ago that if Melnick declared a mistrial, and I mean he had to declare a mistrial, we were willing to make a deal. We'd reduce the charge from murder 2 to manslaughter 1 just to avoid another trial. But no, he's too shrewd for that, Willie is. He takes this as an admission of defeat. He thinks he has a power over juries or something. On retrial, he's going to go down like a fucking stone. 12.5 to 25 he's going to get himself instead of 3 to 6 or 4 to 8. Ray Andreuti gave up wailing down his super sub long enough to say, "Maybe he's smart, Jimmy. If he takes a plea, he's going to jail for sure. With a fucking Bronx jury, it's a roll of the dice every time.
You hear what happened yesterday?
What?
This doctor from out in Montauk?
No.
This doctor. I mean, he's some local doctor out in Montauk, probably never laid eyes on the Bronx before. He has a patient with some esoteric tropical disease. The guy's very sick, and the hospital out there don't think they can handle it, but there's this hospital in Westchester with some kind of special unit for this stuff, so the doctor arranges for an ambulance for the guy and gets on the ambulance with him and rides all the way to Westchester with the guy, and the guy dies in the emergency room in Westchester. So the family brings suit against the doctor for malpractice.
But where do they bring suit? In Montauk? Westchester?
No way. The Bronx.
How can they bring suit here?
Asked Kramer.
The fucking ambulance had to go up to Major Deegan to get to Westchester, so their lawyer comes up with a theory that the malpractice occurs in the Bronx, and that's where they had the trial. $8 million they were awarded. The jury came in yesterday.
Now there's a lawyer who knows his geography.
Ah, hell, said Jimmy Coey.
I bet you every negligence lawyer in America knows about the Bronx. In a civil case, a Bronx jury is a vehicle for redistributing the wealth.
A Bronx jury.
And all at once, Kramer was no longer thinking of the same cluster of dark faces that Ray and Jimmy were thinking of. He was thinking of those perfect smiling teeth, and those sweet full lips glistening with brown lipstick, and those shining eyes across a little table in the very heart of the life, which existed only in Manhattan.
Jesus, he was broke after he paid the bill at Muldowney's.
But when he hailed her a cab out in front of the place and he held out his hand to thank her and say goodbye, she let her hand stay in his. And he increased the pressure, and she squeezed back. And they stayed that way, looking into each other's eyes, and, God, that moment was sweeter, sexier, more full of, God damn it, love. Genuine love. The love that just hits you and fills up your heart than any of those slam-bang first-date scores he used to pride himself on when he was out prowling like a goddamn cat. No. He would forgive Bronx juries a lot. A Bronx jury had brought into his life the woman he had been destined to meet all along. Love, destiny, how full my heart. Let others shrink from the meaning of those terms. Ray wailing down his super sub, Jimmy grousing morosely about Willie Francisco and Lester McGuigan, Larry Kramer existed on a more spiritual plane. Ray's telephone rang. He picked it up and said,
Homicide.
Uh-huh.
Bernie's not here.
The Lamb case? Kramer.
Larry.
Ray looked at Kramer and pulled a face.
He's right here. You want to speak to him?
Okay, just a second.
He covered the mouthpiece and said, It's a guy from Legal Aid named Cecil Hayden. Kramer got up from his desk and walked over to Andreutti's and took the telephone.
Kramer.
Larry, this is Cecil Hayden over at Legal Aid.
A breezy voice this Cecil Hayden had. You're handling the Henry Lamb case, right?
That's right.
Larry, I think the time has come to play Let's Make a Deal. Very breezy.
What kind of deal?
I represent an individual named Roland Auburn, who was indicted 2 days ago by a grand jury on a charge of criminal possession and sale of drugs. Weiss put out a press release describing him as the crack king of Evergreen Avenue. My client was immensely flattered. If you ever saw Evergreen Avenue, you'd ask why. The king is unable to make $10,000 bail and is currently on Rikers Island.
Yeah, well, what's he got to do with the Lamb case?
He says he was with Henry Lamb when he was hit by the car. He took him to the hospital. He can give you a description of the driver. He wants to make a deal.
Chapter 18. Shaman.
Daniel Torres, the fat assistant district attorney from the Supreme Court Bureau, arrived at Kramer's office with his 10-year-old son in tow and a ditch down the middle of his forehead. He was furious, in a soft, fat way, about having to show up at the Island Fortress on a Saturday morning. He looked even more of a blob than he had the last time Kramer had seen him, which had been in Kovitsky's courtroom. He wore a plaid sport shirt, a jacket that didn't have a prayer of closing around his great soft belly, and a pair of slacks from the linebacker shop for the stocky man in Fresh Meadow that made his underbelly protrude beneath his belt like South America. A glandular case, thought Kramer. His son, on the other hand, was slender and dark with fine features, the shy and sensitive type by the looks of him. He was carrying a paperback book and a baseball glove. After a quick, bored inspection of the office, he sat in Jimmy Coey's chair and began reading the book. Torres said,
"Wouldn't you know the Yankees would be on the road?"
He motioned toward Yankee Stadium just down the hill with his head.
"On the Saturday, I gotta come over here. This is my weekend with—"
Now he motioned his head toward his son.
"And I promised him I'd take him to the ball game, and I promised my ex-wife I'd go to Kyle's on Springfield Boulevard and get some shrubs and take them to the house, and how I'm going to get from here over to Springfield Boulevard and then over to Maspeth and then back to Shea in time for the game, I don't know. Don't even ask me why I said I'd take the shrubs over to the house."
He shook his head. Kramer felt embarrassed for the boy, who appeared to be deep into the book. The title was Woman in the Dunes. As best as Kramer could make out from the cover, the author's name was Kobo Abe. Feeling curious and sympathetic, he walked over to the boy and said in the warmest Dutch uncle manner possible,
"What are you reading?"
The boy looked up like a deer caught in a pair of high beams.
"It's a story," he said.
Or that was what his lips said. His eyes said, "Please, please let me return to the sanctuary of my book." Kramer detected that, but he felt obliged to round out his hospitality.
"What's it about?" "Japan."
Pleading.
"Japan? What about Japan?" "It's about a man who gets trapped in some sand dunes."
A very soft voice. Pleading, pleading, pleading. Judging by its abstract cover and dense print, this was not a child's book. Kramer, student of the human heart, got an impression of a bright, withdrawn boy, the product of Torres's Jewish half, who probably looked like his mother and was already estranged from his father. For an instant, he thought of his own little son. He tried to imagine having to drag him over here to Gibraltar some Saturday, 9 or 10 years from now. It depressed him profoundly.
"Well, what do you know about Mr. Auburn, Danny?" he asked Torres. "What's this crack king of Evergreen Avenue business?"
"It's a piece of—"
Torres stopped short for the boy's sake.
"It's a joke, is what it is. Auburn's, you know, just the usual kid from off the block. This is his third drug arrest. The detective who arrested him called him the crack king of Evergreen Avenue. He was being sarcastic. Evergreen Avenue is about 5 blocks long. I don't even know how Weiss got hold of it. When I saw that press release, I couldn't believe it. Thank God nobody paid any attention to it."
Torres looked at his watch.
"When are they going to get here?"
"They should be here pretty soon," said Kramer. "Everything's slower over at Rikers Island on Saturday. How did they happen to catch him?"
"Well, that's a screwy thing," said Torres. "They really caught him twice, but this kid has very big... a lot of nerve, or else he's very stupid, I don't know which. About a month ago, this undercover cop made a purchase from Auburn and another kid and announced they were under arrest and so forth, and Auburn told him, 'If you want me, mother, you're gonna have to shoot me,' and he started running. I talked to the cop, Officer Iannucci. He said if the kid hadn't been black in a black neighborhood, he would have shot him, or shot at him, anyhow. A week ago, he brought him in. The same cop."
"What's he looking at if he's convicted of a sale? 2 to 4, maybe?"
"You know anything about his lawyer, this Hayden?"
"Yeah, he's a black guy."
"Really?" Kramer started to say he didn't sound black, but thought better of it.
"You don't see too many black guys in legal aid."
"That's not true. There's quite a few. A lot of them need the job. You know, these young black lawyers have a rough time. The law schools graduate them, but there aren't any slots. Downtown, it's pathetic. They're always talking about it, but they don't hire black lawyers. That's the truth of the matter. So they go into legal aid or the 18B pool. Some of them scuffle along with a rinky-dink criminal practice, but the big-time black wise guys, the drug dealers, they don't want a black lawyer representing them. The small-timers don't either. One time I was in the pens and this black lawyer from the 18B comes in looking for the client he's been assigned and he starts yelling out his name. You know the way they yell out the names in the pens? Anyway, the guy he's been assigned is black, and he comes walking over to the bars and he looks this guy in the eye and he says, "Get lost, mother, I want a Jew." I swear, he says, "Get lost, mother, I want a Jew." Hayden seems pretty sharp, but I haven't seen a lot of him. Torres looked at his watch again, and then he looked at the floor in the corner. In no time, his thoughts were somewhere out of the room and out of Gibraltar. Kyle's nursery, the Mets, his ex-marriage. His son was off in Japan with a man trapped in the dunes. Only Kramer was right there in the room. He was keyed up. He was aware of the stillness of the island fortress on this sunny Saturday in June. If only this character Auburn turned out to be the real goods, if only he wasn't too much of the usual mindless player, trying to get some stupid game over on everybody, trying to trim the world, bawling into the void from behind the wire mesh. Pretty soon, Kramer could hear people walking down the hall outside. He opened the door, and there were Martin and Goldberg, and between them, a powerfully built young black man in a turtleneck jersey with his hands behind his back. Bringing up the rear was a short, chunky black man in a pale gray suit. That would be Cecil Hayden. Even with his hands behind his back, Roland Auburn managed to do the pimp role. He was no more than 5'7" or 5'8", but very muscular. His pectorals, deltoids, and trapezii bulged with mass and sharp definition. Kramer, the atrophied one, felt a jolt of envy. To say that the fellow was aware of his terrific build was putting it mildly. The turtleneck jersey fit him like a skin. He had a gold chain around his neck. He wore tight black pants and white Reebok sneakers that looked as if they had just come out of the box. His brown face was square, hard, and impassive. He had short hair and a narrow mustache lining his upper lip. Kramer wondered why Martin had cuffed his hands behind his back. It was more humiliating than having them cuffed in front. It made a man feel more helpless and vulnerable. He could feel the danger of falling. He would fall like a tree, without being able to protect his head. Since they wanted Roland Auburn's cooperation, Kramer thought Martin would have taken the man on the easy route. Or did he think there was actually some danger of this bulked-up rock making a run for it? Or was the Martin way, invariably, the hard way? The entourage came crowding into the little office. The introductions were an awkward shuffle. Torres, as the assistant district attorney in charge of the prisoner's drug case, knew Cecil Hayden, but he didn't know Martin, Goldberg, or the prisoner. Hayden didn't know Kramer, and Kramer didn't know the prisoner, and what should they call the prisoner anyway? His real status was that of punk arrested on a drug charge, but at this moment, technically, he was a citizen who had come forth to assist the authorities in a felony investigation. Martin solved the nomenclature problem by referring to Roland Auburn frequently and in a bored manner as Roland.
"Okay, Roland, let's see. Where are we going to put you?"
He looked around the office with its clutter of dilapidated furniture. Calling a prisoner by his first name was a standard way of removing any pretensions of dignity and social insulation he might still be clinging to. Martin was going to put the carcass of Roland Auburn wherever he felt like. He paused, stared at Kramer, then cast a dubious glance toward Torres's son. It was clear that he didn't think he should be in the room. The boy was no longer reading his book. He was slouched back in the chair with his head hung low, staring. He had shrunk. There was nothing left but an enormous pair of eyes staring at Roland Auburn. For everybody else in the room, perhaps even Auburn himself, this was just a routine procedure, a black defendant being brought into an assistant district attorney's office for a negotiation, a little round of plea bargaining. But this sad, sensitive, bookish little boy would never forget what he was now looking at.
A black man with his hands shackled behind his back in his daddy's office building on a sunny Saturday before the Mets game. Kramer said to Torres, "Dan, I think maybe we're going to need that chair." He looked toward Torres' son. "Maybe he'd like to sit in there in Bernie Fitzgibbon's office. There's nobody in there."
"Yeah, Ollie," said Torres. "Why don't you go in there until we get through?"
Kramer wondered if Torres had really named his son Oliver. Oliver Torres. Without a word, the boy stood up and gathered his book and his baseball glove and headed for the other door, to Bernie Fitzgibbon's office. But he couldn't resist one last look at the manacled black man. Roland Auburn stared back at him with no expression at all. He was closer to the boy's age than to Kramer's. For all of his muscles, he wasn't much more than a boy himself.
"Okay, Roland," said Martin. "I'm going to take these off of you. And you're going to sit in that chair there and be a good fellow, right?"
Roland Auburn said nothing, just turned his back slightly to present Martin his shackled hands so he could unlock the cuffs.
"Hey, don't worry, Marty," said Cecil Hayden. "My client's here because he wants to walk out of this place without looking over his shoulder."
Kramer couldn't believe it. Hayden was already calling the Irish Doberman by his nickname Marty, and he had just met him. Hayden was one of those bouncy little fellows whose breeze is so warm and confident you'd have to be in a very bad mood to take offense. He was pulling off the difficult trick of showing his client he was sticking up for his rights and dignity without angering the Irish cop contingent. Roland Auburn sat down and started to rub his wrists, but then stopped. He didn't want to give Martin and Goldberg the satisfaction of knowing the handcuffs had hurt. Goldberg had walked around behind the chair and was settling his hulk onto the edge of Ray Andreuti's desk. He had a notebook and a ballpoint pen for taking notes on the interview. Martin moved around to the other side of Jimmy Coey's desk and sat on the edge over there. The prisoner was now between the two of them and would have to turn to see either one of them head on. Torres sat down in Ray Andreuti's chair, Hayden sat down in Kramer's, and Kramer, who was running the show, remained standing. Roland Auburn was now sitting back in Jimmy Coey's chair, with his knees akimbo and his forearms on the armrests, cracking his knuckles, looking straight at Kramer. His face was a mask. He didn't even blink. Kramer thought of the phrase that kept turning up in the probation reports on these young black male defendants, lacking in affect. Apparently that meant they were deficient in ordinary feelings. They didn't feel guilt, shame, remorse, fear, or sympathy for others. But whenever it fell to Kramer's lot to talk to these people, he had the feeling it was something else. They pulled down a curtain. They shut him off from what was behind the unblinking surface of their eyes. They didn't let him see so much as an eighth of an inch of what they thought of him and the power and their own lives. He had wondered before, and he wondered now, who are these people? These people whose fates I determine every day. Kramer looked at Hayden and said, "Counselor?" "Counselor." He didn't know quite what to call the man. Hayden had called him Larry on the telephone from the word go, but he hadn't called him anything in this room, and Kramer didn't want to call him Cecil for fear of appearing either too chummy or disrespectful in front of Roland. "Counselor, you've explained to your client what we're doing here, right?"
"Oh, sure," said Hayden. "He understands."
Now Kramer looked at Roland. "Mr. Auburn." "Mr. Auburn." Kramer figured Martin and Goldberg would forgive him. The usual procedure, when an assistant DA was questioning a defendant, was to start off with a respectful Mr., just to set things up, and then switch to the first name after things got going. "Mr. Auburn, I think you already know Mr. Torres here. He's the assistant district attorney handling the case you've been arrested and indicted on, the sale charge, okay? And I'm handling the Henry Lamb case. Now, we can't promise you anything, but if you help us, then we'll help you. It's as simple as that. But you gotta be truthful. You gotta be completely truthful. Otherwise, you're just jerking everybody around, and it's not going to be good for you. You understand?
Roland looked at his lawyer, Cecil Hayden, and Hayden just nodded yes, as if to say, "Don't worry, it's okay."
Roland turned back and looked at Kramer and said, very deadpan, "Uh-huh."
"Okay," said Kramer. "What I'm interested in is what happened to Henry Lamb the night he was hurt. I want you to tell me what you know."
Still slouched back in Jimmy Coey's chair, Roland said, "Where you want me to start?"
"Well, at the beginning. How'd you happen to be with Henry Lamb that night?"
Roland said, "I was standing on the sidewalk, fixing to go down to 161st Street down to the takeout, the Texas Fried Chicken, and I see Henry walking by." He stopped.
Kramer said, "Okay, and then what?"
"I say to him, 'Henry, where are you going?' And he say, 'I'm going to the takeout.' And I say, 'That's where I'm going.' So we start walking down to the takeout."
"Walking down what street?"
"Bruckner Boulevard."
"Is Henry a good friend of yours?"
For the first time, Roland showed an emotion. He seemed faintly amused. A little smile twisted one corner of his mouth, and he lowered his eyes, as if an embarrassing topic had come up.
"Nah, I just know him. We live in the same project."
"You hang around together?"
More amusement.
"Nah, Henry don't hang around much. He don't come out a lot."
"Anyway," said Kramer, "the two of you are walking down Bruckner Boulevard on the way to the Texas Fried Chicken. Then what happened?"
"Well, we go down to Hunts Point Avenue and we fixin' to cross the street to go over to the Texas Fried Chicken."
"Cross which street? Hunts Point Avenue or Bruckner Boulevard?"
"Bruckner Boulevard."
"Just so we get it straight, you're on which side of Bruckner Boulevard? The east side going over to the west side?"
"That's right. The east side going over to the west side. I was standing out in the street a little ways, waiting for the cars to pass by, and Henry was standing over here."
He motioned to his right.
"So I can see the cars better than he can, because they be coming up from this way."
He motioned to his left.
"The cars, mostly they be traveling out in the center lane, you know, like a line. And all of a sudden it's one car. It pulls out and it wants to pass all these other cars on the right, and I can see it's coming too close to where I'm standing, so I jump back. But Henry, I guess he don't see anything until he see me jump back. And then I hear this little tap, and I see Henry falling, like this."
He made a spinning motion with his forefinger.
"Okay, what happened then?"
"Then I hear this screech. This car, it's putting on the brakes. The first thing I do, I go over to Henry, and he's lying there on the street by the sidewalk, and he's curled up on one side, kind of hugging one arm, and I say, 'Henry, you hurt?' And he say, 'I think I broke my arm.'"
"Did he say he hurt his head?"
"He told me that later. When I was squatting over him there, he kept on saying his arm hurt, and then I was taking him to the hospital, and he told me, when he was falling, he put his arms out and he came down on his arm, and then he kept on rolling and hit his head."
"All right. Let's get back to right after it happened. You're there beside Henry Lamb in the street, and this car that hit him, it put on its brakes. Did it stop?"
"Yeah. I can see it stopped up the road."
"How far up the road?"
"I don't know. Maybe 100 feet. The door opens and this guy gets out, a white guy. And this guy, he's looking back. He's looking right back at me and Henry."
"What did you do?"
"Well, I figured this guy, he stopped because he hit Henry and was gonna see if he could help. I figured, hey, the guy can take Henry to the hospital. So I got up and started walking toward him and I said, 'Yo, yo, we need some help.'"
"And what did he do?"
"The man looked right at me. And then the door on the other side of the car opens and there's this woman. She gets kind of, you know, halfway out the car, and she's looking back, too. They both looking back at me, and I say, 'Yo, my friend's hurt.'"
"How far from them were you by this time?"
"Not very far. 15 or 20 feet.
"Could you see them clearly?"
"I was looking them right in the face."
"What did they do?"
"This woman, she had this look on her face. She looked frightened. She say, 'Shuman, look out.' She's talking to the guy."
"Shuman? Watch out?" She said, "Shuman?"
Kramer cut a glance at Martin. Martin opened his eyes wide and forced a pocket of air up under his upper lip. Goldberg had his head down, taking notes.
That's what it sound like to me.
Shuman or Sherman?
Sound like Shuman.
Okay. What happened then?
The woman, she jumped back inside the car. The man, he's back behind the car looking at me. Then the woman, she say, Shuman, get in. Only now she's sitting in the driver's seat, and the man, he runs around to the other side where she been sitting, and he jumps in the car and slams the door.
So now they've switched seats. And what did you do? How far away from them were you by this time?
Almost as close as I am to you.
Were you angry? Did you yell at them?
All's I said was, my friend's hurt.
Did you make a fist? Did you make any threatening gesture?
All's I wanted was to get Henry some help. I wasn't angry. I was scared for Henry.
Okay, then what happened?
I ran around in the front of the car.
Which side?
Which side? The right side, where the guy was. I was looking right through the windshield at him. I'm saying, yo, my friend's hurt. I'm in front of the car, looking back down the street, and there's Henry. He's right behind the car. He'd be walking up kind of in a daze, you know, holding his arm like this.
Roland held his left forearm with his right hand and let his left hand dangle as if it were afflicted.
So that means this guy, he could see Henry coming the whole time, holding his arm like this. Ain't no way he don't know Henry was hurt. I'm looking at Henry, and the next thing I know, the woman, she guns a motor and she cuts out of there, laying down rubber. She cuts out of there so fast I can see the man's head snap back. He's looking right at me, and his head snaps back, and they out of there like a rocket. Come that close to me.
He brought his thumb and forefinger together.
Like to tore me up worse than Henry.
You get the license number?
No, but Henry got it, or I guess he got part of it.
Did he tell you what it was?
No, I guess he told his mother. I saw that on television.
What kind of car was it?
It was a Mercedes.
What color?
Black.
What model?
I don't know what model.
How many doors?
Two. It was like, you know, built low. It was a sporty car.
Kramer looked at Martin again. Once more, he had on his big-eyed bingo face. Would you recognize the man if you saw him again?
I'd recognize him.
Roland said this with a bitter conviction that had the ring of truth. What about the woman?
Her, too. Wasn't nothing but a piece of glass between me and them.
What did the woman look like? How old was she?
I don't know. She was white. I don't know how old she was.
Well, was she old or young? Was she closer to 25, 35, 45, or 55?
25, most likely.
Light hair, dark hair, red hair?
Dark hair.
What was she wearing?
I think a dress. She was all in blue. I remember because it was a real bright blue and she had these big shoulders on the dress. I remember that.
What did the man look like?
He was tall. He had on a suit and a necktie.
What color suit?
I don't know. It was a dark suit. That's all I remember.
How old was he? Would you say he was my age, or was he older, or younger?
A little older.
And you'd recognize him if you saw him again?
I'd recognize him.
Well, Roland, I'm going to show you some pictures, and I want you to tell me if you recognize anybody in the pictures, okay?
Uh-huh.
Kramer walked over to his own desk, where Hayden was sitting, and said, "Excuse me a second," and opened a drawer. As he did so, he looked at Hayden for a moment and nodded slightly as if to say, "It's working out." From the drawer, he took the set of pictures Milt Lovell had put together for Weiss. He spread the pictures out on Jimmy Coey's desk, in front of Roland Auburn. "You recognize any of these people?" Roland scanned the pictures, and his forefinger went straight to Sherman McCoy, grinning in his tuxedo.
That's him.
How do you know it's the same guy?
That's him. I recognize him. That's his chin. The man had this big chin.
Kramer looked at Martin and then at Goldberg. Goldberg was smiling ever so slightly. You see the woman in the picture, the woman he's standing beside? Is that the woman who was in the car?
Nah.
The woman in the car was younger, and she had darker hair, and she was more foxy.
Foxy?
Roland started to smile again, but fought it off. You know, more of a hot ticket.
Kramer allowed himself a smile and a chuckle. It gave him a chance to let out some of the elation he was already feeling.
A hot ticket, huh? Okay, a hot ticket. All right.
So they leave the scene. What did you do then?
Wasn't much I could do. Henry was standing there holding his arm. His wrist was all bent out of shape, so I said, Henry, you got to go to the hospital. And he say he don't want to go to no hospital. He want to go home. So we start walking back up Bruckner Boulevard, back to the project.
Wait a minute, said Kramer. Did anybody see all this happen? Was there anybody on the sidewalk?
I don't know.
No cars stopped?
Nah. I guess Henry, if he be laying there very long, maybe somebody stopped, but nobody stopped.
So now you're walking up Bruckner Boulevard, back toward the project.
That's right. And Henry, he be moaning and looking like he's fixing to pass out, and I say, Henry, you got to go to the hospital. So I walk him on back to Hunts Point Avenue, and we go on across to 161st Street to the subway stop over there, and I see this taxi belongs to my man Brill.
Brill?
He's a fella that has two cabs.
And he drove you to Lincoln Hospital?
This fella Curly Kale, he drove. He's one of Brill's drivers.
Curly Kale. Is that his real name or is that a nickname?
I don't know. That's what they call him, Curly Kale.
And he drove the two of you to the hospital?
That's right.
What did Henry's condition seem to be on the way to the hospital?
That's when he told you he'd hit his head? That's right. But mostly he was talking about his arm. His wrist looked bad.
Was he coherent? Was he in his right mind, the best you could tell?
Like I say, he was moaning a lot and saying how his arm hurt, but he knew where he was. He knew what was happening.
When you reached the hospital, what did you do?
Well, we got out, and I walked with Henry to the door to the emergency room, and he went in there.
Did you go in with him?
No. I got back in the cab with Curly Kale, and I left.
You didn't stay with Henry.
I figured I couldn't do no more for him.
Roland caught a glance toward Hayden. How did Henry get home from the hospital?
I don't know.
Kramer paused. All right, Roland. There's one more thing I want to know. Why haven't you come forth with this information before now? I mean, here you are with your friend, or your neighbor, anyhow. He's from the same project, and he's a victim of a hit-and-run accident right in front of your eyes, and the case is on television and all over the newspapers, and we don't hear a peep out of you until now. What do you say to that? Roland looked at Hayden, who merely nodded yes, and Roland said,
"The cops was looking for me."
Hayden spoke up. There was a warrant out for criminal sale, criminal possession, resisting arrest, and a couple of other things, the same charges he was just indicted on. Kramer said to Roland, "So you were protecting yourself. You withheld this information rather than have to talk to the cops."
"That's right."
Kramer was giddy with joy. He could already see it taking shape. This Roland was no sweetheart, but he was entirely credible. Get him out of the bodybuilder jersey and the sneakers, break his hip so he can't do the pimp roll, bury this business of the crack king of Evergreen Avenue. Didn't look good to juries if a major criminal came into court offering testimony in exchange for a misdemeanor plea. But just a clean-up and a trim, that's all this case needs. All at once, Kramer could see it. The drawing. He said to Roland, "And you're telling me the complete truth?"
"Uh-huh."
"You're not adding anything or leaving anything out?"
"Uh-uh."
Kramer went over to Jimmy Cowie's desk, right beside Roland, and gathered up the pictures. Then he turned to Cecil Hayden. "Counselor," he said, "I've got to talk this over with my superiors, but unless I'm mistaken, I think we got a deal." He saw it before the words were even out of his mouth. The drawing. By the courtroom artist. He could see it as if the TV screen were already right in front of him. Assistant District Attorney Lawrence N. Kramer, on his feet, his forefinger raised, his massive sternocleidomastoid muscles welling out. But how would the artist deal with his skull? where he had lost so much hair. Well, if the drawing did justice to his powerful frame, no one would notice. The courage and the eloquence, that's what they would see. The whole city.